On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Pump and Treat Optimization, which is based upon ITRC's performance-based optimization of pump and treat system teams online resources. My name is Taylor Vogel, and I will be your moderator today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, is a program of the Environmental Research Institute of the States, a 501c3 education and research nonprofit corporation affiliated with the Environmental Council of the States. We are a national coalition composed of members from state agencies, federal government, tribal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses. Please visit the ITRC website if you're interested in becoming an active member or need to view the full ITRC disclaimer. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review those terms and conditions in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. I now have the pleasure of introducing our trainers today. All of them served as members of the team and have volunteered to support the training offered today. A quick note before we get started, if you run into any problems accessing a link during the training, you can navigate directly to the main guidance document and use the table of contents to find the specific sections we are referencing. All right, and I'm going to get this started by turning it over to Michael from the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality.
Thanks, Taylor. I just add my thanks to everybody for joining us today and spending time with us. We're going to get started this session with a poll question right up front, just to let the team sort of gauge your experience and things with pump and treat systems and optimization as well. So if you don't mind filling that out, how many pump and treat systems have you been involved with? Anywhere from none to 20 to greater than 25? And of the pump and treat systems you've been involved with, roughly what percent has been optimized? And that'll go anywhere from none to more than 50%. So give you just a few minutes to answer that. All right. And as you can see here, we've got a diversity of experience here. Most people are sort of in that middle ground, 1 to 25, not having a whole lot of experience, but we do have some folks that have a lot of experience today. And as we typically see in this training class, even the folks that have experience with pump and treat, generally we don't have a whole lot of optimization efforts. And that's something that we've been working on, obviously, with the development of this course and things to hopefully improve that number. So thank you for participating in the poll. So let's get oriented to the training course today and just sort of jump in. The audience today, basically, we developed this training generally for anyone involved in pump and treat systems, designing, building, operating, or optimizing them. But we do believe that regulatory agency managers and stakeholders will also find this training beneficial as you learn principles and practices of optimization. We do have one assumption that we make known up front, that while optimization may occur at any phase in remediation, this training assumes that we already have a pump and treat system in place to be optimized and evaluated. We also have an acknowledgement up front that pump and treat optimization, you know, may not achieve all site goals. We have section 4 and 5 of the guidance document to provide support for transition or termination when optimization indicates pump and treat may not be the solution or the sole solution going forward. Optimization goals. The goals of optimization to improve efficiency and effectiveness, maintain and improve receptor protection, ensure adequate maintenance, reduce cost and liability, reduce environmental footprint, and make the remedy more resilient to environmental changes. This training in our guidance document presents processes, tools, and resources to assist you in achieving these goals. Let's quickly summarize key learning objectives for this training. Optimization can and should occur throughout the life cycle of a pump and treat system. We're going to present a systematic process for performance evaluation, process optimization, and system transition. Pump and treat optimization can be beneficial to all parties involved in the cleanup. As you can imagine, optimization can lead to faster, more efficient, timely, and effective cleanup, as well as improved environmental protection, less resource consumption, and a more sustainable and resilient remediation. And these results are beneficial to all the parties involved. Recommendations to optimize the system are based on an iterative performance evaluation. As the system is optimized, we get more data and that's gathered through the process and can be evaluated, and recommendations will be made as to whether further optimization is necessary. Optimization will improve an existing system, but it can't fix everything. The performance evaluation may demonstrate the system cannot achieve the objectives alone or possibly at all. The decision may be to pair pump and treat with another remedy or even replace it entirely. And as we're probably everyone on this training is aware, optimization or any of these processes are not formed in a vacuum. There are numerous parties, stakeholders, regulators, as well as regulated entities that need to be involved in optimization decisions and implementation. The regulatory framework and sustainable resilient remediation options also need to be considered. Today's training is broken up into the four main sections: life cycle optimization, pump and treat performance evaluation, process optimization and management for evolving conditions, transition and termination. During the training, we'll be using a case study Baytown to show the optimization process in practice. The Baytown Township is a Superfund site in Minnesota. Additional case studies are found in Appendix B of the online document as well. The optimization life cycle diagram is a navigation that's designed to serve as a roadmap for this training today, as well as our document when you go to the online resource as well. We also integrate regulatory, stakeholder, and resiliency considerations throughout the training. The guidance document includes individual sections for these considerations. But during the presentation today, you'll see the following icons used to highlight our integration of these considerations into the presentation. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Lucas for our first section to cover life cycle optimization framework.
Thank you, Michael. So this section provides a framework for conducting optimization during the life cycle of a groundwater pump and treat system. And this document focuses on the life cycle beginning after the pump and treat system has already been designed, built, and has been operating for some time. And remedy optimization is really an important component of a life cycle approach for both identifying and implementing optimization practices in an adaptive manner. So this slide presents the section objectives, and they include identify when opportunities for conducting optimization can occur during the life cycle of a groundwater pump and treat operations. And these opportunities typically can be identified based on the performance evaluations, which will be discussed. The second is to understand how optimization reviews can result in substantial cost avoidance or savings and also reduce the time to completion. The third objective is to be able to identify the opportunities to increase the ability to influence remediation costs. And these opportunities can occur throughout the life cycle of the operation of the pump and treat system, as we'll see. And the fourth objective of this section is to be able to evaluate how performance-based pump and treat optimization can be used to ensure the effectiveness and efficiency of the remedy and that it's maintained throughout the life cycle of the remedy itself. So this schematic provides an overview of a pump and treat system, and pump and treat systems have been selected as components of remedies for various types of contaminated sites. Think Superfund, RCRA, various state programs over the last several decades. And before we delve into the framework, we're going to review the components of a pump and treat system. So the first component is aquifer interception, and this includes a network of wells or trenches for groundwater extraction. We use pumps to extract that groundwater, and we place those extraction wells to really intercept the contaminant plume or provide hydraulic control, prevent offsite migration, or even to reduce source by mass removal. The second is the conveyance system, and this is the mechanical hydraulic infrastructure, which also includes piping to convey the groundwater from the extraction locations to the above ground treatment system. The third component is the treatment control component, which includes contaminant control, alteration, reduction, or destruction. It's really the above ground ex situ treatment processes for treatment of that extracted water, and this also includes processes and systems for sludge generation and management. The fourth component includes the discharge system for the extracted groundwater. And this is really the disposal. Think of this as the disposal system for treated water. It could include another well network for reinjection back into the subsurface. It could include discharge to a surface water. It could also include discharge to a publicly owned treatment works or POTW. The fifth component is the energy that's required to operate the system. And this includes power controls, power supply and controls. And the last component is the monitoring system. And this monitoring system includes monitoring of the above groundwater treatment system and also the in situ system of extraction and monitoring wells. The in situ system consists of the monitoring well network that includes wells, piezometers, there may be downwell meters and sensors. And then for the above ground system, that also includes a variety of meters and sensors to monitor the above ground treatment system itself. So this is our second poll question. And the purpose of this question is to test our knowledge before we present additional material. So the question is, when in the pump and treat life cycle should we consider optimization? Is it the pump and treat selection and design, implementation of the system, evaluation that the system is functioning as designed during normal operation and maintenance, site completion, or all of the above? So if you could take a little bit of time and answer, we can then review the results. Okay, great. So the majority of the folks got the answer that we were looking for, F, all of the above. And the answer to the poll question is really based around that the framework for conducting optimization during the life cycle of a groundwater pump and treat system really begins with initial site assessment. It runs through design, implementation, long-term O&M, and remedy transitioning or site completion. So really throughout the life cycle, we can perform optimization. And what we're going to review on the next slide is the stages of remedy optimization as they apply to the assessment and cleanup process. So for this training, optimization efforts will really focus on the later stages of the remedial process. And those are the two highlighted columns on this slide, remedy implementation and post-construction activities. Remedy implementation corresponds to the design of the pump and treat system, and associated life cycle activities include pre-design investigation of sources and plumes, could include treatability testing, pumping tests, And other activities could include the design, or typically include the design of extraction wells and their placement, development of a monitoring network, establishment of pumping rates, design of conveyance piping, design of the treatment processes, and selecting equipment. Remedy implementation also corresponds to the installation of the pump and tree system and startup and early operation of that system. And some life cycle activities include installation of the extraction and monitoring wells, construction of the conveyance piping, and the treatment and discharge systems. And this also could in does, often includes system startup and shakedown, and we may even modify equipment at this stage. The second major activity is post-construction activities, and they correspond to ongoing system operation and monitoring, late life cycle operation, including the transition to system shutdown or an alternate technology such as monitored natural attenuation. Some of the associated life cycle activities include continued assessment of hydraulic capture zones, modification of pumping rates, operation and maintenance of the system and the extraction wells. And we can also include at this stage system shutdown evaluations and possibly transition to M&A or other treatment technologies if they're more cost effective and also technically practical. And post-construction activities also correspond to closeout and deconstruction of the pump and treat system. And this includes abandonment of extraction wells and conveyance piping and demobilization of the treatment works. Next, we're going to review the role of performance evaluations in optimization. So the components of a performance assessment include first, the evaluation of the above ground treatment system performance, and that includes the conveyance piping and equipment, the treatment system, and the discharge processes. And the treatment process monitoring refers to measurements of influent flow rate to the plant, the treatment plant, measuring concentrations of treatment plant influent and effluent, and also at various intermediate points in the treatment process. And one of the primary criteria of evaluation at this stage is to verify that discharge standards are being achieved following treatment. The second component is evaluation of subsurface performance, and this includes plume capture and containment, and also recovery performance for the plumes, performance of the extraction and injection well networks. And what we're concerned about here is that the effectiveness of a subsurface remedy really depends on the accuracy and completeness of the conceptual site model, and therefore requires a high degree of performance monitoring to address any site uncertainties that may significantly impact system performance. So in this case, the frequency of monitoring, which is a key parameter, is based on the rate of change of hydraulics, contaminant trends that we might observe, geochemical changes that we might measure in the subsurface, and also proximity to receptors. And these are all important aspects of the conceptual site model. The third component is monitoring both below and above ground. And this also includes reporting, project management as well. And monitoring of the contaminant concentrations and groundwater levels, those are compared against predicted performance, along with evaluating the pumping effectiveness of the extraction wells themselves. And all of this information helps to determine if the extraction well network configuration is continuing to provide the most effective and efficient recovery. And this evaluation is most often conducted individually for each well, and we also conduct that along with other components of the performance evaluation to indicate if adjustments to the pumping rates, or maintenance such as well cleaning is needed, or installation of new wells might be needed to maintain, or increase the recovery efficiency. And ultimately, the evaluations mentioned on this slide produce the data that we use in optimization assessments. So this slide shows some considerations and associated data related to the performance-based approach that we describe in the manual. And data really informs how we conduct optimization. Performance assessments conducted at a site can help us update the conceptual site model periodically. They can also be used to identify whether the remedy performance is evolving as predicted and whether the remedy is likely to achieve cleanup goals. And this table presents considerations and the data that we use for the performance-based evaluations. So when considering these items, there are a few specific variables that will help inform next steps. And these include that the conceptual site model update, the CSM update, will consider data and information that's collected during operations to inform further adjustments to the system. This could include new knowledge of preferential flow paths, for example. Changing conditions considers data on additional sources, additional massive contaminant, changing concentration distributions, and so on. Controlling contaminant transport is really about evaluating the aquifer and the hydraulic conditions. And in this case, one example might be that new pumping locations might be needed to adequately intercept the groundwater plume. And finally, remedy performance evaluates well design and pumping performance. And an example of this is that adjustments to pumping conditions may be warranted if sufficient capture or mass removal isn't being attained. So here we have another poll question, and this is to test our knowledge before we present additional material. And the question is, how can optimization typically affect cost of remediation efforts over time? Choose all that apply. A, it may decrease the accuracy of the estimates for long-term costs. B, it may increase costs due to longer operation timeframe. C, it may decrease costs due to shorter operation timeframe. D, it may increase monitoring costs over time. And really think about the term optimization. Okay, great. Most people selected C. And the key word here is typically. Conceivably, A, B, and D could certainly occur during a project. But with optimization, what we're trying to do is reduce the effort if it's appropriate based on the performance of the system. So next, we're going to see how this can be visualized for a project lifecycle. So this is a two-part figure, and right now we're showing the top part of the figure, and that depicts effort and cost per year versus time for a typical evaluation and cleanup effort at a contaminated site. And what you can see is that in the initial stages of a site response, much of the effort is necessarily focused on characterization, risk determination, remedy evaluation and selection, and source control and remediation. As the project matures over time, resources are increasingly spent for monitoring and treatment system operation and maintenance. We know that monitoring can be an extensive cost component and can also proceed for an extended period of time before the remedy is selected and implemented. And as indicated by the dashed line at the word site closure, technical remedy performance uncertainties may impact the accuracy of the estimates for long-term costs. The bottom part of the figure shows that instead of continuing indefinitely with a long-term O&M operation and maintenance, it is possible through optimization to reduce operation costs as well as the time to complete site remedy. And depending on site-specific conditions, optimization reviews can result in substantial cost avoidance and savings and also enable reductions in time to achieve site completion. And it's important to note that optimization has a greater ability to influence lifecycle costs if performed during the early phases, planning, investigation, design, and early system operation. And highest influence of costs is in the planning stages. And early incorporation of independent optimization reviews or application of optimization lessons learned into the remedy selection, design, and even procurement phases, we've found that to be quite effective. And the ability to influence project costs decreases through construction and operations, maintenance, and monitoring. So here we are introducing the case study, the Baytown Township groundwater plume site, and this will be discussed throughout the training session. And some of the key features are that trichloroethene, or TCE, was first detected in private wells in 1987. The site was added to the NPL in 1994. It's a fairly large plume, about 7 square miles, and it's a deep plume, up to 270 feet. There's a hydraulic containment system that's been operating since 2008. And for this system, a hydraulic barrier system consisting of a network of groundwater extraction wells was installed. There's an air stripper system to treat the TCE impacted groundwater. Treated groundwater is reinfiltrated into the subsurface. During the operation of this system, a problem was identified in terms of rebounding and fluctuating TCE levels, and that resulted in an optimization review performed in 2011. And this case study really illustrates the framework presented in the ITRC pump and treat optimization guidance. And during the course of this training, we'll use this site to walk through the steps of evaluation, optimization, and transition and termination of the system. So the key takeaways for this section include the opportunities to conduct optimization can occur throughout the life cycle of groundwater pump and treat operations. Optimization reviews can result in substantial cost avoidance, savings, and also reduce the time to completion. Opportunities to increase the ability to influence remediation costs include improving operations, modifying the remedy, and/or streamlining the remedy progress monitoring. Finally, performance-based pump and treat optimization uses data to maintain the effectiveness and efficiency of the remedy. And with that, I'd like to pass over our training session to Pat Lachlan to review the performance evaluation.
All right, thank you. So this section addresses the performance evaluation of an existing pump and treat system. The results of the evaluation are utilized at the stage of the system optimization, which is gone up, will be gone over in section four. So here's how the performance evaluation fits within the life cycle of a pump and treat project. One thing that needs to be emphasized is that the performance evaluation may need to be conducted several times and at different stages. For example, before the optimization stage to provide data for the optimization and after to establish how the optimization affected the system performance. We'll talk about the triggers, the objectives, and the process of doing a performance evaluation. So this figure was covered extensively in the last section, but it does show the components that could trigger a performance evaluation. All the components may be subject to performance evaluation at some point in the process. The subject of this module is the evaluation of the performance of an existing pump and treat system. So the discussion focuses on the systems that have been operating for some time. The initial design is not addressed. The main points of this module are: why would a performance evaluation be conducted? What are the objectives of doing it? And how is the process conducted? The treatment system assessments are discussed in other documents, and some are listed in section three of our document. So the key takeaways from this module Now, the performance evaluation is an iterative process and should be conducted when needed at different points in the project lifecycle in conjunction with other lifecycle events. An example is to evaluate system performance before and after the optimization process. Performance evaluations should be part of the general operation of the system and project milestones, such as completion of the source remediation. It can also be triggered by significant external events, such as natural disasters. Resiliency and sustainability should be included in the evaluation process. You should assess performance under power outages or checking the energy usage. It's important to point out that conducting the evaluation doesn't necessarily imply that changes need to be made. The result may indicate that the pump and treat system is still the most advantageous option, and there are few opportunities for improving the existing system. The best course of action may be to continue with the system as it is. And finally, when doing an evaluation, ask yourself if the pump and treat is still the best option. So here's our first poll question. What can trigger an evaluation of the pump and treat system? Remediation milestone, a major external event, new regulatory limits, lack of progress, stakeholder concerns, or all of the above? This is a knowledge check. So we're looking for the typical reason for initiating a performance evaluation. Ah, everyone got it right. Yes, any of the listed triggers can cause you to do a performance evaluation. It's an integral element of the remedy and should be conducted routinely. However, there are specific triggers that require that more than routine evaluation efforts are in order. For convenience, they may be divided into internal and external. So internal drivers are those that are directly related to the performance of the system. There can be a number of these drivers. Some common drivers are that there is new info that su substantially changes the understanding of the project. It may concern the hydrogeology, the fate and transport. You can ask, does the CSM need to be updated? Is the current system still able to provide containment? Has a new contaminant been discovered? If so, can the treatment system address this new constituent? Poor performance or deterioration of performance. This may be occurring if there is loss of capture, slow aquifer restoration. It could be a loss of capacity of the extraction wells, or you're exceeding the discharge limits. Unexpected outcomes could include you're affecting a nearby wetland by lowering the groundwater table, you're redirecting the plume towards a receptor, or you're affecting nearby water supply systems. External drivers are those that are not directly related to the system performance. Instead, they're an effect of outside factors. There can be a number of these drivers. Some common external ones are listed here. Budget issues, for example, triggered by a change in the site ownership. Regulatory considerations. So, if there are changes in the standards, such as inclusion of new contaminants of concern, a recent example is PFAS. If there are more stringent discharge limits, different monitoring or reporting requirements, or even if there's a transition of agency leads. Stakeholder issues are sometimes a driving force. Stakeholders often have intimate connections with a specific site and are the first to notice changes through remedial efforts, such as the stream is the wrong color, the system is too loud. Stakeholder issues may come to the forefront as a result of changes to the makeup of the surrounding community. Then you have sustainability and resilience considerations. Especially for older systems that were not originally designed with that in mind, the considerations may come to the forefront. Issues like extreme weather or climate change, the carbon footprint, the water reuse, energy efficiency, and its ability to function under adverse conditions. So we discussed why a performance evaluation would be required and what are the objectives of conducting it. Now we will touch upon those objectives. There are two main high-level objectives. The first one is to assess whether the pump and treat is fulfilling its goals. These are generally related to providing capture of the plume and achieving the treatment of the extracted groundwater in accordance with the discharge limits. Sometimes there's also an objective of affecting contaminant of concern mass removal, either from the source or from the plume. The second project goal is to provide data for future use in process optimization or system transition and termination. Various performance evaluation activities may be related to one of those objectives or both. So I don't expect you to be able to read this figure. It's figure 3.3 in the main document. However, we'll walk through this flow chart to discuss a performance evaluation process. So, how is a performance evaluation done? You would review the compliance data for exceedances, evaluate external forces and the ability to isolate the issues, determine if your process functions as designed. You may need to collect more data. Evaluate your system maintenance. See if that is causing problems with your system. Evaluate your individual process steps. Do you still need them all? Do you need to add an extra step? Determine if your system operation is cost-effective. And use all of that information to determine if an optimization is needed. Are there any corrective actions needed, or is it time to transition away from pump and treat? So this is just one example of the process. Not all steps are applicable to every site, and they would need to be adjusted for your particular site's needs. So what activity would not be directly related to performance evaluation? Assessing whether hydraulic capture is being maintained, assessing whether discharge limits are being achieved, obtaining contaminant of concern mass removal history, acquire historic contaminant of concern concentration data, or assess the applicability of other remedial technologies. So you've done your evaluation because of some internal or external driver. Okay, the majority of you did get the one. Assessing the applicability of other remedial technologies is more related to your actual optimization steps. The first four are related to the two high-level objectives of the performance evaluation. And the fifth activity is not part of the evaluation, but later optimization and system transition. All right, so this is the case study we're following throughout this training. Here we'll talk about its triggers, objectives, and process. So the triggers were the rebounding TCE concentrations in the pump and treat system after initial in situ chemical oxidation source treatment in 2011 and 2015. This was an internal driver related to poor performance. There were costly long-term monitoring of residential wells with varying concentrations, and that's an external driver for budget considerations. And they found data gaps in the source zone. The Vados zone was an ongoing source, and this is an internal driver, and it was found during the evaluation. So this is also new information about possible additional sources. The objectives were to optimize the pump and treat costs and energy requirements and decide if there's a more efficient approach. More in situ chemical oxidation, reductive chlorinization, or monitored natural attenuation. They reevaluated the system several times using capture zone analysis in 2010 after shutting down one well. They did Mann-Kendall analysis to evaluate changes in contaminant concentration at each well. In our Appendix A in the document, we go into modeling discussions and other common concepts. There are many more case studies in Appendix B, each with a unique trigger and outcome. So again, our key takeaways. As seen with the case study, multiple iterations of evaluations were performed. These were triggered by groundwater conditions and costs. The performance evaluations should be conducted at regular intervals over the life of the project. Climate change and rising utility costs should be taken into consideration when doing your evaluations. Don't be surprised to find that your system is already operating optimally. And keep an eye out for opportunities to transition away from simple pump and treat. Next is our first Q&A session.
All right, thank you, Pat. As she mentioned, we have now reached our first live Q&A break of the training. We will have this one, which is about halfway through, and then another one at the very end. So if you have any questions for our trainers, please feel free to pop them in that Q&A pod. I do have a couple questions for our trainers while we wait for possibly more to come in. First one, is there a maximum or minimum time to run pump and treat?
This is Lucas from Woodard and Curran. I don't mind starting and would definitely welcome other panelists adding on to my answer. But in terms of a maximum or minimum time to run a pump and treat system, I think it's dependent on the project objectives typically, but there's also some, I think, commonalities that we see across pump and treat systems. In terms of a minimum time, that might be prescribed by perhaps a work plan or certain project objectives, such as removing mass or preventing offsite migration of a groundwater plume while other source control technologies are being implemented. In terms of a maximum time frame, oftentimes, what we see are that these pump and treat systems sometimes reach asymptotic conditions, and that could represent a maximum time frame and maybe a point to consider an alternate approach for the site.
All right, thank you, Lucas. Michael, did you have something to add?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, from a regulatory standpoint, Lucas is correct. Typically, the ones that I deal with, they have some sort of remediation endpoint they're trying to get to. And so we use a periodic evaluation to determine whether we need to transition or do something different. as we go along the process, but we don't necessarily do it from a time frame as much as reaching those endpoints.
Thanks for adding on to that, Michael. Another question. How is the performance evaluation separate from a 5-year review? Is it appropriate to conduct an evaluation during the 5-year review, or would it be more appropriate to recommend a performance evaluation be completed?
Hi, yeah, this is Pat. It could be conducted as part of the 5-year review. That is one of the drivers. You've got a review that's got to be done for an EPA site. So you do an evaluation. You might do an evaluation between in the middle of the 5-year, or it could be you just do it then. But it is something that's done periodically, either on a schedule or when you notice something has changed with the system.
All right, thank you, Pat. Michael, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to add there. I mean, I deal with solid waste landfills in Virginia, and typically we don't necessarily have a 5-year. A lot of ours is based on the remedy that's chosen, and the driver on a lot of the time frames for us is data frequency. If you're running statistics and things, sometimes that evaluation has to have a certain number of data points. So until you get the minimum data, you really can't run the statistics to do that part of the evaluation. So like for MNNA, we normally have a 3-year cycle for active for pump and treat. Once we get the minimum data points, we're going to be looking at really evaluating how that's performing on an annual basis. And they submit annual reports for us for active remedies, but like I said, the stats and some of that evaluation process can't occur until you get the minimum data points.
This is Dave Becker. Thought I would just jump in here. I just wanted to mention that when developing the optimization framework that my former employer, Corps of Engineers, used, the anticipation was is that we would often do the optimization in conjunction with the 5-year review. And in my experience in my career, there were quite a number of optimization studies and performance evaluations as part of that were done in conjunction with 5-year reviews. So I think they're a natural combination. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Pat, Michael, and Dave, for those perspectives. And then I'll just ask one more question before we continue with the training. This attendee asked, we have a biomonitoring system for our pump and treat, and we are considering an optimization of getting rid of the system and introducing a cheaper option with the same results. Do you think this is possible, and what are the steps to begin this process?
This is Bruce Kennington with Ramble. I can speak to this. Much of what is discussed in Section 5 of the guidance document that I'll be presenting here shortly is in transition and termination that addresses pretty much what you're talking about here in this question. It's looking for, a lot of times the pump and treat system, you get to a point of diminishing returns where the pump and treat system, depending upon what your remedial objectives are, reaches asymptotic conditions like Michael was mentioning, or just, cannot do anything more. You might get into a back diffusion limited transport type scenario where pumping isn't going to make contaminants come out of the bedrock any faster. And so in that particular case, you're looking at alternative remedies. Bioremediation in situ is certainly one of those technologies that could fit that, and evaluating that. But I'll be presenting in the Section 5 section of the guidance document, a suggested process for transitioning, going from just straight pump and treat to another technology or a combination of technologies. Back to you.
All right, great. Thank you, Bruce. And I think that is a good question to end on, since that is a little bit of a teaser for what we'll get into in the next section of the training. But thank you all for the questions, and we will have one more opportunity to answer questions live at the end of class today. So use that Q&A pod at any time during the training. We are monitoring it throughout. And I will now turn this over to Dave, to talk a little bit about process optimization.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Taylor. Yeah, we're going to jump into the next step in that life cycle that that we talked about before, and this is one of my favorite aspects of optimization. One of the favorite things I got to do for the 25 plus years at the end of my career, and that was to develop recommendations based on the performance evaluation that Pat just talked about. So, we are talking about developing recommendations that build upon what was done as part of the performance evaluation, and like kind of like to say that the performance evaluation discussed in section 3 of our guidance document and the development of optimization recommendations kind of go together like peanut butter and jelly. So they're part of a sandwich that really should be thought of together. And the idea here is that we're trying to improve and reduce. We're trying to improve performance, just make it work better. We're trying to reduce costs and time to attaining those objectives. And so we're trying to make it better, faster, cheaper, and greener as well. So we want to reduce the environmental footprint a little bit. So just to kind of return to the life cycle chart that's shown here on the right, we're kind of smack dab in the middle of that life cycle here with the optimization and developing these recommendations. Okay. So key takeaways from my module that we'll talk about here are developing recommendations that address a number of aspects of the remedy. And that includes the subsurface performance. You know, that's where we're trying to make things happen and to, you know, improve and protect the environment, right? But part of that is also to address some of the performance issues with the above ground treatment system and develop recommendations that address that. And then also to look at the monitoring programs, both subsurface monitoring as well as the monitoring necessary for the above ground treatment system. So, part of the recommendations involve perhaps incorporating other technologies in conjunction with pump and treat, and then transitioning to other approaches such as natural attenuation. And as Bruce mentioned in the Q&A session there, he's going to talk about that in depth, okay, in terms of that transitioning and closure. So, but I'm going to talk about these recommendations that I just mentioned. Okay, so before I jump into the recommendations, I think it's really prudent to talk about sort of the human aspect of the whole optimization process here. In my experience, the project teams are often very apprehensive when they find out that some type of independent optimization team is going to be coming and taking a look at the project that they're responsible for. You know, they view it kind of as an audit that they're going to be, you know, accused of making drastic mistakes and you know, they're going to look bad, right? But in reality, optimization should be, and in my experience, has been a forward-looking exercise that we're not trying to attribute any kind of, you know, blame or anything like that, that we're trying to really improve things going forward. And so it's really the future that we're focused on. And I always try to convey to the project teams that there's no reason to feel like they've done anything wrong or bad, that it's just natural to do optimizations. It's really important because we have to adapt to the changes and hopefully to the changes that we're causing by doing the remedy. Hopefully the cleanup is progressing to where the plume is shrinking and things are getting better. And you know, so we have to adjust that. And so that's natural. And plus, in a lot of cases, the design for the remedy was done quite some time ago using technology that was current at that time, but doesn't reflect the technologies or the best practices that have evolved since then. And so this is an opportunity to point out these newer practices and equipment and that kind of stuff that can really improve those performance aspects that we talked about before. So it shouldn't be a bad thing. It should always be forward looking. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the first category of some of the optimization recommendations, and that would be the recommendations related to the conceptual site model. Okay, certainly that's kind of a focus of some of the performance evaluation, but then there's recommendations that grow from that, and probably, certainly in my experience, one of the most common recommendations related to the conceptual site model is the need to do additional site characterization, more detailed, higher resolution in particular, particularly for the source area, because it's often apparent, even where mass removal is one of the goals, we may not be achieving what we thought we would achieve in terms of reductions in concentrations. And a lot of times that comes from our maybe misunderstanding of the source area architecture. So, in my optimization studies, I've often had recommendations related to that. Another area that often comes up is just through reading the background material about the site, identifying the potential for additional contaminants may be present that haven't been looked for, and particularly the emerging contaminants, the scourge of PFAS, even some of the older emerging contaminants, things like 1,4-dioxane or perchlorate. A lot of times we would make recommendations that, yeah, they better look at it. Not always something they want to hear about. Another area related to the CSM is making some recommendations to maybe better clarify changes that have become apparent in terms of groundwater flow directions, maybe climatic impacts like reduced saturated thicknesses of the aquifer that's being pumped. Maybe additional data should be collected and should be recommended in order to better evaluate the appropriate actions to take because of these changes. Okay. So, I do want to highlight that ITRC has some very good guidance on advanced site characterization and high resolution site characterization, and I refer you to that document for more guidance. So at this point, kind of in that vein, let's take a poll question. And I'm really curious to find out how many of you as attendees have had to undertake additional site characterization after the remedy has been implemented, has been operating for a while. So yeah, just fill out this question and we'll see what this cadre of attendees have had in their experience here. So I'll give it just a few seconds and Taylor, when you think it's appropriate to close the poll, we'll see what the results are. And yeah, so it seems like quite a number of people had responded yes to that. I guess the total is a good majority. So appreciate your feedback on that. And frankly, I'm not surprised by your answer. So excellent. Thank you for sharing. Let's go on now. Let's now talk about some of the recommendations that would address the subsurface performance. And I should point out that, on these slides, you see the references to specific sections within the guidance document. And if these are things that you're interested in, it would be very good to refer to the guidance document to these particular sections. So hopefully that helps guide you rapidly to what you want to find. A lot of the recommendations that I've seen, and I think is typical in the community for subsurface issues, has to do with adjustments to pumping rates, locations, in order to either address inadequacy of capture, containment of the plume, or to adapt to the progress that's been made in shrinking the plume. And it could be as simple as just modifying the pumping rates at specific wells, tweaking that, raising some, lowering others. That may require different pumps in some of the wells, or it may actually involve the installation of additional wells in more suitable and more optimal locations. Modeling can go a ways with that. Matter of fact, I should point out that Appendix A in the guidance document has some very good discussion about some modeling tools that would help optimize these systems even more formally, mathematically, to identify the best locations and the best pumping rates among the available wells. In some cases, the recommendations may be to make the remedy more resilient to things like climate change or the potential for flooding. And so there are some resiliency issues here, and I refer you to Section 6 of the guidance document for more ideas related to resiliency. Another really common area of recommendation has to do with the maintenance for the extraction wells. And a lot of times we have problems with biofouling or mineral precipitates that occlude the screen, or in some cases may actually have corrosion issues with metallic well materials like that. And so the recommendations may be better practices to one, identify the problem, two, to address it with good maintenance and restoration activities for that. And some of that same concept actually goes back to even the piping that conveys the extracted water to the treatment plant. It may be that there would be some recommendations to more closely monitor pressure drop across a length of piping to identify the onset of plugging within the piping. Maybe some recommendations for practices such as plugging or maybe installing some cleanouts that allow pigging cleaning of the piping. Or if corrosion or capacity is an issue, maybe even having to replace the piping with piping of larger sizes, larger diameters, for example. And one other thing that I forgot to mention regarding the subsurface performance and the pumping I'm particularly kind of interested in is the wetting of extraction and injection, particularly of treated water, to enhance the cleanup and to speed the attainment of some cleanup goals. By injecting the treated water, not only do we conserve a valuable resource of groundwater, but we can also, with the right placement, increase the flushing that occurs and increase the rate at which concentrations hopefully diminish within at least parts of the plume. So it's a way to contract that plume faster and speed our cleanup. So again, focus a lot on this just because this is where we're trying to implement changes in the subsurface. Okay. Let's go now to our next topic, which has to do with the above ground treatment system. What are some of the recommendations for that? This is covered in section 4.3.3 in the guidance document. Some of the recommendations are really just tweaks to the system. That could be dosages of chemical additions. It could be changes to the flow rates, for example, the airflow rates in an air stripper to better tailor the air water ratios for necessary for removing the contaminants at the concentrations we're now experiencing. So it could be tweaks. It could be a little bit more involved with that through the modification or replacement of specific pieces of equipment in the treatment train, maybe switching out some expensive treatment step with something that now, based on lower concentrations or diminished flow rates, something else might work better. So that's a more aggressive kind of recommendation. Another common recommendation is to increase the level of automation within the system to reduce the labor costs and reduce maybe the time necessary for an operator to be on site. So maybe the integration of or replacement of a site control and data acquisition or SCADA system with call-out opportunities or capabilities to allow the operator to respond to emergencies but not have to be there as often. That can really help reduce costs and can also help make the system a little bit more reliable. So the last major area of recommendations has to do with the monitoring program, and this is covered in section 432 of the guidance document. And I always say that the monitoring optimization is sort of finding the Goldilocks point for the monitoring program. You don't want to have too much data. You don't want to have too little data. You want to have just the right amount of data to support the decisions you need to be making. So the monitoring needs to take into consideration where groundwater is going, how fast it's moving, what the contaminant concentrations are doing. Are they changing rapidly? Are they changing slowly? Where are the exposure opportunities? And so, based on that, and that gets back to the conceptual site model, we make recommendations to change the sampling frequency, where samples are taken, how the samples are obtained, how they're analyzed, and the reporting of that. And so, the frequency of sampling, in my opinion, should be based on how quickly concentrations appear to be changing in the subsurface, and how much time you have to react to an unexpected result before some kind of unacceptable exposure might occur. If you would have lots of time and things aren't changing very rapidly, frequency doesn't have to be that high, right? It could be less. The locations have to be in the right spot. A lot of times our monitoring programs are inherited from the characterization phase, and now that we're in remedy phase, we may have some redundancies in the monitoring network. So that's always a good reason to take a look at the monitoring network if you basically just took all the monitoring wells and included it in the program. Sampling methods, particularly, early in my program, starting in the late 1990s into the early 2000s, we were often making recommendations to change sampling methods to go from, good old purge, bale and sample to, or low flow to passive diffusion bags, for example, for volatile organics. So that was, a consideration, and that should also be considered now. Analytical methods have evolved and continue to evolve for things like PFAS. So updating those analytical methods more focused on what the actual risk-driving contaminants are is always a good one. And then reporting shouldn't be too frequent, but should be often enough to support the decisions in a timely way, given the time frame you have to react to unexpected things. So there are some computer tools that can help with monitoring optimization. These are detailed in Appendix A of the guidance document. I encourage you to look at that. And I also want to point out that any changes to the monitoring program usually require changes to a monitoring plan that needs regulatory approval, buy-in, and that's also covered in the document in Section 7 of our guidance document. Okay. So, what about something even more, intense than just modifying the equipment and system that we've got? What about adding enhancements? Well, that's often a recommendation as well. So we may keep our pump and treat system, but in order to maybe address source area or areas of persistent higher concentrations, we may want to implement some other technology, particularly in situ technologies, that will more cost-effectively address those particular areas. And so it's very common to suggest, integrating these other technologies along with the existing or some modification to the existing pump and treat system. So that's pretty common. And then, of course, there ultimately is going to be the discussion about transitioning parts of or maybe the entire pump and treat system to other technologies, including monitored natural attenuation. And Bruce is going to talk about that in the next module. So I'm going to let him deal with that very effectively. And I do want to point out that in some cases, at some sites, the pump and treat system may be just an interim measure to control the migration while maybe other technologies are being designed and implemented with the anticipation of the pump and treat system would at some point in the nearer term be rendered moot and unnecessary. So, that doesn't happen very often, but could be for a newer site. So, let's go on to our next topic here, and that this is really kind of an interesting area, in my opinion, interest of mine, has to do with the cost estimating for optimization. And recommendations are great, but for those who have to make decisions, they really need to be informed about the cost benefit of this. Essentially, for some investment now, especially one that's meant to reduce cost, do we get a payback in a quick enough fashion to justify the investment now? So, and even for any measure that would shorten the life cycle for the remedy, is it worth investing now, given that benefit in the future? And particularly for more aggressive treatment, say integrating some kind of aggressive source treatment along with your pump and treat to say contain the plume, how long is it going to take to really get a payback on that, especially if we're dealing with decades or even longer time periods for remediation? It becomes very difficult to put costs around that. And sometimes, the only way to deal with it is through some type of modeling, transport modeling or something like that. So that becomes a very difficult thing to implement as part of the optimization study. And so there's uncertainty that has to be communicated to the decision maker. Lastly, the evaluation report for the optimization study can have different levels of completeness to that. So if the optimization study report is going to be distributed to various agencies, regulatory agencies, for example, maybe it needs to be a standalone document that has site background, description of the system, current conditions, the objectives, as well as the performance evaluation results and the recommendations. If the document's really only for the project team, they already pretty much know the background, they know what's there. The focus should really just be on the findings of the performance evaluation and those recommendations and the cost impacts that I was talking about. Okay, so another poll question, just kind of a test here to see if what I've said has made sense. We've got a hypothetical system here. It's a pump and treat system that has been in operation since 1992, long time. So it has air stripping for the treatment of the extracted water, presumably volatile organics. It has high labor and maintenance cost, but they've made some progress. The volatile organic plume has been shrunk in its footprint about half, and the concentrations have declined about 70%. And I know a lot of sites that are kind of like this. Okay, so of the options that are shown on this slide, what might be potential recommendations that you would make to optimize this system? And choose any that you think would apply. Okay, so you've got four to choose from there, update and maybe increase automation, replacing some of the equipment, maybe well pumps, optimize the well field, in other words, the pumping rates and locations, rehabilitate wells and piping because maybe fouling, that kind of stuff. So, which of those, would you include potentially in your optimization report? We'll give you just a few more moments to complete that. And then Taylor, if you'd be so kind to at some point close it, and we'll see what folks chose. And you all did pretty doggone well. Pretty much any of those would be potential optimization recommendations. And so they all got about the same response, which is really good. So good job, folks. I didn't put you to sleep here. So let's go on here. And just to bring it back around to our case study at Baytown as an example. And Lucas, I believe, had mentioned that there was a 2011 optimization evaluation there. I was actually part of the team that did that optimization for EPA. And there were a number of recommendations that were included for that case study. One was to continue to try and address the source term. If not with continued ISCO at the time, maybe to consider in-situ bioremediation as an alternative. And then there was also some recommendations to maybe do a couple of neat little tricks to try and better characterize the source architecture underneath the building that was present at the site. For the down gradient dissolved phase plume, there was a recommendation to do some additional detailed modeling to address the impact of natural attenuation, including reactive iron minerals at the site. The performance evaluation identified some potential issues with the pump and treat system that was close to the source area to make it work better, and there were some concerns about that, and we really recommended a more formal capture zone analysis be done. We had some recommendations to improve the monitoring program, including the use of passive diffusion bag samplers, but also to look at doing some more statistical analysis of trends within the concentrations observed at the down gradient private wells. Some other optimization recommendation, there were a number of them related to the above ground treatment system, everything from cutting back on some of the blower airflow rates for the air stripper to save some energy, turning that down a little bit, to implementing more routine inspections of some of the equipment, particularly the electrical system, because that had been some problems there. So there was a variety of stuff related to the above ground system. One interesting thing was to actually relocate a filtration step. It was between the air stripper and a treated water holding tank before reinjection, but they recommended that the filtration be implemented after the holding tank. So anyway, there were some good recommendations there. There were also some recommendations on how to electronically manage the data and the content of reporting and the frequency for reporting. So kind of covered the bases there. So just some key takeaways from this module. The recommendations from the optimization may include those related to treatment system and the monitoring program. There's recommendations that would suggest modifications to the subsurface system, extraction and injection. And then maybe some recommendations related to the CSM, such as additional detailed high-resolution site characterization, for example. And of course, as I mentioned, for any of these, that the cost impact should be explained after they've been assessed in a report. And some of the recommendations would be related to transition or incorporating transition to or incorporating other technologies. And that's probably a good segue to go into our next module that Bruce is going to talk about on transition and termination. So turn it over to you, Bruce.
Thank you, David. My video is working here. For some reason, I'm not seeing my video. Can you see me, Taylor?
Yes, we can see
Okay,
you.
good. Sorry. Section 5 of the guidance document is transition and termination. Previous sections presented by Patricia Loughlin on performance evaluation by this time should have already been completed before you get to thinking about transition or termination. Certainly, the section that was just previously presented by Dave Becker regarding optimization of the treatment system should have taken place. And in some instances, for systems that operate for quite some time, and there's other things that come into play, Some of these performance evaluations and optimizations may have taken place multiple times for a project. Here we have revisiting the life cycle for a pump and treat system. Where we are right now is at the tail end. So what we'll be talking about in section five is system transition and ultimately system, termination, where you're essentially transitioning off of pump and treat to another technology or a technology that enhances the pump and treat system. But ultimately, once you've achieved the objectives for remediation of a particular site, you've achieved your remedial goals, you'd be looking at terminating the system. And so we'll be talking about these. This is at the end of the life cycle for a pump and treat system. So this applies to end of life. Like I said, performance evaluation optimization should have already been completed. And the reason why we put this together in this document is to help support folks to implement and most efficiently and expeditiously implement a transition process. So this provides a certain logic, if you will, about how you might go about doing it. Understanding that not every site is the same for a lot of reasons, being environmental professionals seems like every site is different from another. The regulatory framework might be different. The contaminant certainly could be different. The geology, et cetera, hydrology, everything. So that's what I love about this business. But, not every site is the same. Similar to what we discussed in different sections, the other previous sections are some key takeaways here. And we'll revisit this at the end of my presentation of the section. The first thing is kind of like, how do you know when you're there? What are the key indicators that you might look for? The other thing, which is the transition plan, how do you go about doing this? In trying to accomplish things, certainly in the environmental remedial framework that we all operate in, having a plan and being organized about it can help inform how you might best go about doing it. But most importantly, and this will be a recurring theme throughout what I present here, which is keeping all the stakeholders engaged and bringing them along on the journey, if you will. So, state, federal, or other stakeholders, maybe tribal nations, indigenous peoples, things of that nature, the public, different public action groups, things like that. They may be, depending upon what and where you're doing your remediation, would be key stakeholders. So, we'll talk about the importance of a transition plan. And then under that transition plan, we'll present sort of a framework for a step-by-step process. How do you go about doing this? And what are the different stages that can help formulate a transition process? And like I said, not all site is the same. There's lots of ways you can go about doing it. I think this is something that you need to consider for your own particular site to have an understanding of what's the best way of accomplishing this yourselves. And then, like I said, last but not least, is the importance of engaging, stakeholders early during the process, and also, looking at different ways of gaining support for the transition by considering different sustainability and resiliency aspects for remediation, and certainly in a transition. Here we have a poll question here, similar to what was presented in the other sections. This is intended to sort of just gauge people's experience. So there is no correct answer here. And I don't know, Taylor, I don't know if they can select more than one response here, but just select the best response that fits your experience. So this is your experience with transitioning on different pump and treat system projects that you may have executed. Was it easy? Was it smooth? Or was it clumsy, chaotic? Or maybe you don't have experience with pump and treat systems, but there's no correct answer here. We'll take some time for folks to enter their response, and then Taylor will give us a tally. All right. Well, this is interesting. We've given this training quite some time, a number of times. A lot of the people that have participated here, over half, have had no experience with the transition whatsoever. A lot of times, what we also see in the poll responses is that It never, very rarely is accomplished easily. Typically, it can be challenging. I don't know, clumsy or chaotic may describe things for you. But that's one of the reasons why we wrote this guidance document, which is to help promote ways you can go about doing this. All right, moving on. So, transition and termination plan, essentially laying things out, kind of providing a map, if you will, of how you might go about doing it. Sometimes, similar to the previous sections for performance evaluation and optimization that we presented in sections 3 and 4 previously, there are different things that you may gain an understanding of through the lifetime of operating a pump and treat system. In almost all instances, certainly my experience has been, after operating a system for several years or up to a decade or more, you'll know way more about how the system performs, what it's doing, all these different things than you ever would have envisioned when it was incorporated into the remedy to begin with. So it's important to understand what's going on, update the conceptual site model to reflect improvements or increased knowledge or understanding of the site. But overall, having a plan about going about doing this enables you to come up with an efficient and cost-effective way that you're going to implement a remedy. What additional data needs to be collected to get you to the step-by-step process that we'll talk to next. But also in putting together a plan, the first thing is recognizing that you're there. So there's key indicators that will be present. And then again, discussing that with the key stakeholders on it so that you have buy-in on this transition journey. So that's a very important thing. Again, bringing the stakeholders along on this journey. So again, as I said, transition planning, presenting a plan shows that like a, you can put together a step-by-step process or even what your strategy is, for transitioning. A lot of times this, again, you may have performed performance evaluations multiple times, but you get to a point where enough is enough in the pump and treat system. It's not accomplishing anything more than what it may have done early in its life cycle. And there are, new technologies may have come into play. Certainly, a lot of us as professionals have seen that in the past 15 to 20 years. Improvements in in-situ remediation approaches for addressing things in a wide variety of manners. And these are all things that speak to, hey, what's the best way if we're going to transition? What's the best way, a plan of attack to essentially going and implementing this transition? All those things we talk about the performance evaluation, the optimization. One of the things that's also a consideration when you build a pump and treat system and you have an O&M plan. And again, I look at this in terms of bringing the stakeholders along with you, that you lay out a potential transition process as part of the O&M plan for a system. Sometimes that forethought isn't there yet because you may not have gathered all the data that shows how the system is actually performing, how the aquifer is responding, all these things after several years of operation. But I think early thinking ahead and looking at this early and saying, okay, this is what I expected. This is what I'm seeing. Maybe we're getting close to reaching asymptotic conditions, for example, is one good example. But starting early and including data collection as part of your O&M plan to show that at some particular point you may be looking at transition or certainly shutting down the pump and treat system, it's better to think about how am I going to demonstrate that early on so you're collecting the data as you're moving along. That's the end of the end of that story. Here's a step-by-step process for achieving transition. The first, as I mentioned, is what trigger conditions may be present. How do you know that enough is enough? What sort of triggering conditions might there be? The next is once you think that you have different indications that you might be looking at transitioning off of pump and treat and doing something else or augmenting the pump and treat. What the things that would help support that are things such as in taking the data that has been collected so far in the system, and updating your conceptual site model. The conceptual site model, it may things may vary quite differently from when you initially put together things after an RI, for example, to after you operate a pump and treat system for several years. You gain information about how everything responds to the pump and treat system operation. You could also, look at establishing the lines of evidence to support transition. Some of these things we've already talked about, which are pretty common with pump and treat system, which is, reaching asymptotic conditions. Are you at a rate limiting approach on the pump and treat system, where operating the pump and treat system is not going to make the mass flux coming out of the aquifer change anything through continued operation? Looking at the groundwater plume, what plume behavior are you seeing? This is all these data that you should be collecting during O&M period of the process of operating the system to see how the plume is performing. Is it shrinking? What sort of projections might you have in terms of reducing the overall aerial footprint of the impacts of groundwater and the groundwater plume? But then also considering new technologies or even other technologies that might be applicable, reevaluating those. I mean, reevaluating previous technologies that might have been considered at the time that the pump and treat system was selected as an alternative, but also looking at new technologies. And last but not least is implementing the transition. That might be a hard stop. You're done. Remedial goals have been achieved. You're demonstrating to the stakeholders and the regulators that, yep, we're here. We've accomplished the remedial goal objectives, and that may require multiple sampling events to show that you're there. Certainly more than one in my experience. But then looking at the overall performance, what else can so help support transition and implementation of the transition approach? Getting into some of the specifics related to each of these steps in the step-by-step process are trigger conditions. There's other factors as well, such as continued operation of the pump and treat system. The cost of continued operation exceed the benefit of continued operation. Certainly that there might be more effective and efficient alternatives. But then also, again, this is on the cost side. You're consuming more energy. Depending on the type of system you have, you may have considerable waste generation that continues, particularly if you're using something like activated carbon, and you've got other solid waste that are being generated from chemical physical processes, like if you have chemical flocculations, settling type projects where you're generating solids due to operation. So these are all important things to consider when you may be looking at transitioning that helps support making that transition. Then also to put in here is shouting out and reconsidering sustainable resilient remediation considerations in the operation, continued operation of the pump and treat system versus something else. And that this can be important factor in gaining consensus for transitioning off of pump and treat to an alternate technology. This is just a basic example of a cost benefit curve. In this particular case, it's the amount of mass removal rate, the mass removal rate over time versus the cost, which would be in this particular case a climate change related greenhouse gas gases being emitted. At some particular point, you're getting diminishing returns on mass removal, but you've got the same amount of greenhouse gases that are being removed. So on a a pound of mass per greenhouse gas emitted basis, you've got you're past the point of diminishing returns. Okay, how to implement the transition? Certainly is identifying what would be the appropriate, remedial alternative. This is part of the transition plan. Is it monitored natural attenuation? Is there particular in situ treatment technologies? And there's lots of them out there. Or are there other ways of dealing with this such that human health and the environment are protected by the remedy? A lot of this has to do with developing these lines of evidence. So This could be taking a look at what's happening with plume, like I said, plume behavior, contaminant, response to continued operation of the pump and treat system, or no response. The pump and treat system is not doing anything more to what's presently there. But essentially, developing those lines of evidence and going out and collecting that information to demonstrate that it's appropriate, that we're here, we're ready to make this transition. This is a simple table. It's presented in the guidance table 5-3, just showing examples of lines of evidence. This is not the end all be all for all lines of evidence that may be out there, but like I said, looking at what's happening with the contaminant concentrations, plume behavior is another good example, and then taking a look at different performance and cost factors with continued operation of the pump and treat, system. The other thing that we bring into, and this came up in one of the other discussions earlier for the earlier chapters, which is reasonable time frame. If the pump and treat system's not doing anything more, a lot of times reasonable time frame factors into this. Is there a better way to shorten that time frame without just operating the pump and treat system? Last is step three, which is implementing the transition. Typically, this can be the latter part of a transition plan. How do you go about doing this? And this can depend upon your site, how things are behaving on the site, etc. But it could include a hard stop. You stop operating the pump and treat system, or it could be phased or simultaneous. A lot of pump and treat projects I've been engaged in, you could start with a hard stop where you're doing rebound assessment, or essentially doing back diffusion assessment if you're in fractured media, for example, fractured bedrock media. So it does tend to be very site specific, and is based on those performance characteristics for the alternate remedies or alternate technologies you're looking to implement. Will they be able to improve upon just pump and treat system by its pump and treat remediation by itself? The thing to th think here is that you should be flexible here, but laying it out, as a process, bringing along the stakeholders, obtaining regulatory approval and transition is always very important, and gaining consensus to move forward. And last, at the end of the process life cycle, is system termination. Clearly, if you're in a regulated community, this would require regulatory approval. There may be additional evaluations that take place. Like I said, if you do a hard stop, then you continue monitoring for a while to see if your assumptions in the transition process are correct. Do you have significant rebound or not? But ultimately, if you have demonstrated that you're there, and also that from a risk standpoint, particularly for the regulated community, that you satisfied those concerns in terms of perception of risk and whether the contaminant could cause or continue to pose a continued threat to human health or the environment. You need to make sure that you address that. But ultimately, this would result in final deactivation and decommissioning of the system. We'll go back to the Baytown case study that we talked about in the earlier chapters. So this is the same site. In this particular case, we'll talk about what they did in this on this Minnesota site to go through the different steps in this transition process. One of the things that they specific to this site that they did is they looked at in situ remediation. The pump and treat system by itself, because there are source areas that remain beneath a building, for example, it was not able to would not be able to achieve remedial action objectives within a reasonable time frame, and so there were alternate technologies that were considered in situ that included in situ chemical and enhanced reductive dechlorination. And then ultimately, once they completed that transition evaluation, they shut down the pump and treat system and they continued monitoring, and they transitioned to M&A. It took a period of about 5 years. So we'll talk a little bit more specifics here. So here's the steps. What sort of trigger conditions did they observe? In this particular case, diminishing returns in a source area that wasn't being directly addressed. So what they came up with was a transition approach. Developed multiple lines of evidence and did some pilot studies evaluating these other technologies, and ultimately selected enhanced reductive dechlorination and achieved their objective, their immediate objectives, and they shut down the pump and treat system. But also, as part of shutdown, there was a monitoring plan that was implemented to essentially show that what they achieved was correct, and that the shutdown was appropriate. Okay, hopefully from the key takeaways that we discussed at the beginning here, the key indicators that are needed for transition and termination. How do we know when enough is enough? We talked about the value of a transition plan to guide project teams, but also to bring along the stakeholders involved on your project. Coming up with a stepwise process that include identifying trigger conditions, putting together a transition plan, and implementing the transition plan is that stepwise process we discussed. Every site is, unique and different, and so that needs to be factored into how you go about coming up with this transition plan, and also considering the stakeholders. But also, as much as you can, considering sustainability or sustainable resilient remediation in your process with the key stakeholders that you have. Back to you, Taylor.
All right, thanks, Bruce. Guys, we've covered a lot of information today in a fairly short period of time. So let's do a quick recap. Lucas walked us through the lifecycle optimization framework. Pat covered performance evaluation concepts in section 3 of the guidance document. Dave talked about the process optimization management for evolving site conditions, which is in section 4 of the guidance document. And Bruce, we just heard from for system transition and termination, which is section 5. The key takeaways from the training today, we'll just review real quickly. Optimization should occur throughout the life cycle of a pump and treat system. We've heard and presented a systematic process for performance evaluation, process optimization, and system transition. This process can and should be used throughout the active life cycle of the pump treat system, regardless of the regulatory framework. Pump and treat optimization can be beneficial to all parties involved in the cleanup. And the recommendation to optimize the pump and treat system is based on iterative performance evaluation process. Ultimately, optimization will improve an existing pump and treat system, but it can't fix everything. The performance evaluation may demonstrate that the system cannot achieve the objectives alone or possibly at all, and the decision may be to pair that with another remedy or even replace it in its entirety. And we talked about that its optimization is not performed in a vacuum. Regulatory framework and sustainable remediation needs to be considered, as well as the stakeholders, regulators, and the other parties involved in those decisions. I just remind you that the pump and treat document is available on the ITRC website under guidance documents. After the training, the document can be utilized as a resource for additional information, and it's sort of set up in a pick-your-own-adventure fashion to let you focus on just what you need at the time. So if you just need section 5 or section 4 or one of the other ones, you can go straight to those and just look at that. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Taylor for questions.
All right, thank you, Michael. As was mentioned, we've now reached the final Q&A portion of the training today and the wrap up. So I do have a couple questions for our trainers before we close out today. First question I see in the Q&A pod, does transition and regulatory approval typically require an FS level evaluation and ROD amendment?
I can speak to that, Taylor. This is Bruce. Haven't done this myself a number of times under Superfund. So we're talking Superfund framework with records of decision on things like that. The answer is it depends. In terms of how the agency might go about either amending or describing a significant difference in the ROD remedy is from an administrative standpoint is pretty much up to the EPA what route that they go. Will that be necessary? That's what you need to would need to be discussed with your client counsel and certainly the regulators to see what might be the appropriate pathway. And then in order to be able to get there to demonstrate that the change is appropriate. So that could involve a lot of things I talked about in the Section 5 transition process, which it could involve a different additional data collection. Could involve additional efforts to update the conceptual site model and to prove that you are where you are. Could include hydraulic evaluations. I have a pump and treat system for a Superfund site in New Jersey where we did all of the above. because the way that the ROD was written, it indicated that the pump treat system would not be able to be turned off. So we talked with the agency about an ESD, an explanation of significant differences, to sort of clarify what was not envisioned when the ROD was written, so that it could explain that transition to M&A was appropriate. So hopefully that answers your question. It really kind of depends, but I in terms of like mapping out the process and whether it's going to involve something that's FS level or something more or less, it's going to be very site specific and best certainly discussed and addressed with the stakeholders to be able to come up with that transition process. Back to you, Taylor.
Taylor, if it's okay, I'd like to add on what Bruce mentioned.
Go for it, Lucas.
I've gone through this recently on a record corrective action site. And in that case, we had to do a shutdown evaluation, as kind of Bruce and others had mentioned previously. I think David mentioned as well, and provide demonstrable information and data to show that the residual impacts that were remaining would not migrate and that the plume would not expand. On a state lead program, we're currently evaluating a shutdown of another pump and treat system. And in that case, we've performed a number of injections in different source areas to address residual source areas, and the concentration of the pump and treat system have become asymptotic and below essentially risk-based discharge levels. And that's a project where the state is the lead authority, and it also defers. It's also in a state where there's environmental professional lead programs, so it's up to the environmental professional, in this case, someone on our team, to develop a approach and data set that they feel comfortable defending in terms of a shutdown of that pump and treat system. So, as Bruce mentioned, it kind of depends on the project itself.
All right, thank you, Bruce and Lucas, for your perspectives on that question. Another question in the Q&A pod. What is your recommended time to allow for rebound observation?
This is Bruce Taylor. Ask your hydrogeologist. It can vary based on the aquifer matrix, the contaminants that are involved. That's why it can be complicated. It can be modeled, but as with every model, you have to have good inputs into the model to make sure it's taking into all the considerations that Mother Nature throws at you. It can vary. But in order to be able to assess how long it's going to be rebound, from my experience, it's beneficial if you can justify to the regulator based on, some sort of calculation or otherwise, that this is the appropriate time, to for how long it might take to assess rebound. So you're talking, what is the contaminant mass discharge out of the matrix going into the aquifer? What's the groundwater flow going through? How much is being effectively transported away? There's a lot that goes into this, as you can possibly imagine. But my suggestion would be to have a basis for justifying how long that you do it, instead of just saying, let's go do rebound testing, and I think it's going to take 2 weeks. that's going to be very hard, I think, to get approval for. Whereas if you had a basis, a calculation that supports it, that you could do it. My experience with doing rebound testing is that you can have a supporting calculation or whatever, but then you're going to go out there and be prepared to spend sufficient time based on what you see. So start doing it, monitor it, and see if your assumptions are correct. And but you may have to be doing this for longer than your calculation might support. That's my two cents.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. I do not see any other open questions in the Q&A pod. So I will wrap up this training now. There we go. All right. So I first wanted to thank you all for attending this training today, and a big thank you to our expert trainers for being here and for their contribution to the ITRC document and for volunteering to deliver this training. And we would like to hear back from you. So please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. I'm also going to drop it in the chat now. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. And if you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thanks again, everyone, for attending today's training and interacting with the Q&A pod and knowledge checks. We hope to see you on another one soon. Bye, everyone.